Good evening. You're listening to KKRN 88.5 FM Community Radio out of Round Mountain in Bella Vista. This is Jim Dowling, host of Right Stuff. And I've got a very special guest here in the studio with me, Michael Schlosser. Mike has written a book about Vietnam. And, well, I can tell you, it hit me pretty hard. It took me right back to my high school days and some of the anxiety I felt about possibly being drafted. And so, Mike, why don't you kick us off by telling us a little bit about your past, and then we'll get into the book.
I grew up in Wisconsin, high school 60 to 64, and then college 64 to 68. So I was right in the entire decade of the 60s. And I think one of the things that impacted me early on in the war was that we were from a very, very small town in Wisconsin, 300 people. And one of my classmates was with the first 3,500 Marines that went to Da Nang in March of 65. And then by September of 65, Jimmy was killed over in Vietnam. And we didn't even know at that time where Vietnam was. I mean, the war was just starting. There had been a police action for many years. And now we got a kid that we grew up with. I mean, it was, you know, people had died before he died, but it really brought the war home to us.
Sure.
And then I was a sophomore in college in 65, and you had a college deferment for 4 years. So you knew at the end of May 68, you were next in line to go. So it really impacted your life tremendously. We were well aware of the war. We focused on it. And we watched it on TV every night, sitting at home in our living room along with everybody else in the United States. It was America's first reality show. And you began to realize the death count was rising. By the summer of 67, 20-some thousand guys that got killed, people that got killed over there already. And so the reality of the war really impacted our life and our colleges, our futures, everything. So the
draft was still a few years off, and the people going to Vietnam, like Jimmy, were people who enlisted. He was part of the first Marine wave at Da Nang, right?
65. Yeah, the Selective Service actually operated during that time. Mm-hmm. And they were drafting people.
Oh, were they?
But you could get deferments for various reasons. College, you can get a 4-year college deferment. Medical obviously excluded you. Some professions, teachers and that, some professions were considered protected, if you will. So there was a number of ways to avoid the draft. Obviously, health issues.
Can I ask what year it actually started, the draft?
The draft came in 1964 when I was a senior in high school. They were drafting people, but there was a variety of reasons you could get deferments. 4-year college deferment was obviously the one that I was under, but you could get medical deferments, jobs. There were some jobs like teachers that were protected, and obviously medical reasons. And it was not till December 1st of 68 when they went to the draft where they pulled the birth dates on the little ping pong balls out of a thing, and your position in line was dictated by your birthday, and then some correlated date was with your birthday. So, but they were drafting bodies at that point in time.
So you basically had 4 choices. Mm-hmm. We know that connections were really important. We know that Donald Trump got out for bone spurs.
That was a letter. You could get letters from your doctor. There were many ways to get out. Guys would go for their physical. You had to pass the physical. And they'd drink all night long before their physical, drive their blood pressure. Oh, they'd eat tinfoil to have something show up in their stomach, as dots in their stomach. And they were all going to get fake letters from their doctors. If you had enough money, you could buy a doctor's letter for nothing. I mean, for easy. Yeah, so there was a lot of, and another real problem was you had local draft boards. And in these poor communities, you know, the poor black kids were the first ones drafted, not the white kids. Unfortunately, where I grew up, there was, you know, we had a college deferment, and that was it. There was no excuse after that. You were gone. And that's exactly what happened to me. I got out of college in May of 68, and August 1st of 68, I was drafted.
Yeah. Well, I think it's important to paint a picture that it was different for different people.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
definitely.
The enlisted person went with enthusiasm. You know, this is a war that's important, and I need to fight for my country.
That's the patriotic call to duty thing.
Well, and our parents were part of what we call the greatest generation. There was that was still around and strong. You know, your country calls, you go.
And they fought a war. They fought a real war, though, fighting for the survival of America. Vietnam was based on some hypothetical theory of the domino theory. If we don't stop the communists over there, they'll come to Hawaii, and then they'll be knocking on California's door. So the whole premise was
abstract. Yeah, and then when you go to Vietnam, you probably see a country that's underdeveloped and go, what's this domino theory? You know, are these people really threatening the United States?
Yeah, I don't like the word third world country, but those people lived in such conditions that we couldn't even understand how, you know, thatch roof houses, dirt floors, pigs, and water buffaloes living right in the house with them. And it was such a shock to our system to see such a different culture. And the problem we had was we couldn't identify the enemy. That was one of the problems we had. We never were taught who the good guys and the bad guys were, because a lot of the Viet Cong, they were farmers during the day, and then at night they're out there running, shooting, setting up ambushes, setting up booby traps. And during the day, you couldn't shoot them because there were farmers in the fields out there. So there was so many rules. And it was just frustrating, extremely frustrating.
Yeah, yeah. My recollection of those times being in high school is looking at TV and lots of graphs and people going, you know, we're winning. We took over this chunk of the country in the last week, and here's the body count to prove that we're winning this war. And then all of a sudden you get these big battle setbacks. And so trust of the media went downhill, at least for my generation. And
when the whole body count thing was such a farce, absolute farce, and I saw it firsthand. I mean, you know, if we'd find a speck of blood, well, that was reported as a body count. I mean, that was to the level we found a poor farmer that stepped on one of their own booby traps in a ditch one day, and he was counted as body count. I mean, it was just, everything was fake. Everything was wrong over there. It was just, and that's why by 68, 69, when I got there, I always said we were no longer a military force.
So you were fighting in jungle conditions most of the time, correct?
I use the word swamp.
Swamp.
The Mekong Delta, the Mekong River comes down through Vietnam. You know, it's about 800 miles from the Oregon border to the Mexican border, and from the DMZ in Vietnam to the bottom of Vietnam was about 750 miles. So it's like almost the length of the entire state of California. But it all ends up down the bottom in the Mekong Delta, which is about 15,000 square miles of swamp. It's just a terrible place, to be and live and exist. And that was our home for a year. We lived out in the swamp with the mosquitoes, the rats, the leeches, everything that bit, snakes. And I mean, it was unbelievable the conditions that we had to endure during that year. And that's why when I wrote the book, I described the book not as a war story. I'd read tons and tons of war stories, but what I wrote the book was is trying to explain to people what life in that prison camp was like. I mean, we were taken from society and put in a maximum security prison camp where there was no escape. You couldn't leave. You know, Hawaii was 6,000 miles away, and you couldn't go into Cambodia or Laos because, I mean, they were ready to shoot you or couldn't speak the language. So you were in a security, maximum security prison from which there was no escape, and that's why the whole concept becomes you just got to stay alive for the 1 year that you were sentenced to the prison. And it's and the contents of the inside of the prison was pretty harsh, pretty harsh place to stay. So
yeah, and the book's title, Stalag Vietnam, and you chose that title because it was what?
Well, in September 65, there was a TV series that came out called Hogan's Heroes.
Sure.
And it was a group of American prisoners of war during the Second War, and they were being held in a Stalag, which Stalag 13, which was the German word for a prison camp. And that's what I felt this was, is that we were taken from society, and we were basically sent to a prison camp, and we had a year sentence, 365 days. You could talk to anybody over there and ask them how many days you got left, and they could tell, everybody to the day could tell you when their prison sentence was up.
Wow.
No, I didn't look at it. I mean, most people didn't look at it as a prison sentence. Most of a lot of guys over there were doing their civic duty, but the draftees, by 69, there was a lot more draftees than in the beginning. So that's caused the attitude of the military, you know, the fighting force, to change dramatically, because we weren't there on any patriotic mission to stop an enemy. We were just there to do whatever we had to do to stay alive.
Sure.
And survive not only the Viet Cong and trying to kill you, but also the swamps trying to kill you. I mean, you know, it was wicked.
Well, you know, it's important to remember those times. I was of a very skeptical generation. You know, I was there during the middle of the civil rights thing, and that heated up just as Vietnam heated up, and it was a time when we were questioning
everything,
and the music and the lyrics.
Well, the music was changing it. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
And the other thing that I relate that year, I went to high school in Wisconsin, College of Wisconsin, and never once during that 8 years was I ever exposed to even pot.
Yeah.
But then you step off the plane in Vietnam, and you could get anything you wanted, anything, heroin, speed, opium. In the movie Platoon, with that Oliver Stone did, he shows that the two bunkers, you know, when they're in the fire base, that one bunker is filled with all the guys that are smoking pot and just singing and dancing, and then the other barracks building was where they were singing country western songs. So there was real. But the drug scene was huge, absolutely huge. And I believe that's caused a lot of these guys were coming home from Vietnam,
sure,
bringing back drugs, mailing drugs home,
mm-hmm,
bringing seeds home. I mean, so if you look at the explosion of the drug community in the United States, I think a lot of it belongs to putting 2.5 million young kids in Vietnam in a 10-year period of time and exposing them to copious amounts of drugs. It has to have a negative impact on our society. So,
well, you quoted, made some very interesting quotes early in the book about statistics.
Yes.
Do you know those offhand, or can I give you the book here?
In the back, this was written by Major General Hank Stelling, U.S. Air Force retired. I tried to contact him, but he's deceased. I was going to ask for his permission to publish that.
Well, there are 58,267 names now listed.
Yep.
on the wall. I've been there. I actually got to take some high school students there.
Oh, neat. I've been there, too.
Yeah.
The statistics that I think are fascinating, and there's 997 guys got killed on their first day in Vietnam.
Wow.
And 1,448 died on their last day in Vietnam. That doesn't count, you know, all the guys. Imagine, we always said, imagine doing a year over here and getting killed on your last day.
Oh,
you know?
Boy.
Your best. I mean, if you're going to get killed, you might as well get killed when you step out of that airplane, you know, because that saves you a lot of pain and misery for that year. So,
well, okay, and it changes you, right? I mean, going to Vietnam, you come back and you realize you're in a world that doesn't interpret what you've been through at all. They're very naive.
Beyond that, they didn't even want to hear about it.
Sure.
See, there was our parents' generation were true war heroes. They won the war and saved the United States from Hitler and Japan. Okay, and those guys were heroes, and I grew up with those guys. My father worked in a power plant along the Mississippi River, and they hired, in those days, they were hiring ex-Navy guys for, because they were on ships and they knew how to run boilers and turbines and all that kind of stuff. So when I grew up with all these guys, my father's friends. They were all Navy guys, a couple Marines, a couple Army guys, and war stories, war stories, war stories. Well, when we came back, they didn't want to hear our stories because we weren't in a war. We were in this police action over there, and one of my pet peeves to this day is, I'll probably get in trouble for saying this, but the VFW wouldn't allow us to join Vietnam veterans.
Really?
Yeah, no, it was, see, because Vietnam was never a declared war. It was a police action. VFW stands for Veterans of Foreign Wars.
Yeah.
So those guys, it took quite a number of years before they realized all the World War II guys were dying off and their club was going to come to an end, so they decided to let Vietnam vets in, and I've been recruited many times, and I refuse to go near the place because if you're not good enough then, you're sure is not good enough now on the place. So that was issue. So not only that, but you couldn't even tell somebody you'd been to Vietnam because if you told them, they would actually physically recoil from you, like, you know, you're this maddened killer, and we were viewed as baby killers. And that's what they'd seen on TV, you know, the crazy stuff that was, because, again, it was shown on TV because it was the first war we ever had cameramen embedded. I mean, World War II, they had cameramen with them, but anything you watched on TV was a video of something that had happened that had been cleaned up. They had cameramen over there in the fighting battles with the soldiers over there. And so it was reality TV, and so the people in the United States developed a real, almost hostile attitude.
Sure.
And then there was the protests in college. It was interesting because our parents' generation thought we were just ripping up the college campuses for no reason. The kids were saying, this war is wrong. We got close to 50,000. We're starting to hit by 69, and we got to get the guys out of there. We're not winning. We're losing. And you had the ability, you had to just kind of step back from it, you know.
Yeah.
And that's what we did. We stepped back and just hid the fact that we were in Vietnam for many, many years, you know.
Yeah. So. Okay, well, we're going to take a little station break here. You're listening to KKRN 88.5 FM Community Radio out of Round Mountain in Bella Vista, and I'm talking to Michael Schlosser here. He's written a book, Stalag Vietnam, about his experience over there. And so we've been on the subject a little bit about how war changes you. Is there? Can I get you to read a little excerpt from your book?
Sure.
Okay. You take your pick. The ones that I have selected here, one is called Pain, and the other one is Facing Death.
Either one. One interesting aspect of war is the knowledge that you get when you have faced death. Anyone who has faced death has a special knowledge that not many people have. I know what it is, and I know how I react. I do not have to wonder what it is like. On several occasions, I faced death with total certainty of the outcome. I knew it was going to happen. It was simply a matter of having death get it over with. I knew that day in the swamp, on the dike, that there was no way out. I knew that day sitting on the mine that one single move would end everything. These are life-changing events that will impact your life forever. You will never be the same again. I'm not yet sure how much going to war changes a person. Time will reveal that answer. Yet the strength or weakness of the experience provides you with an understanding and knowledge of yourself. I have learned that nothing really matters, only death. Something over which I have no control. Something during my time in Vietnam I lost somewhere. During my time in Vietnam, I lost my will to live. Time will tell how we all react to the experience. This war has already taken a great toll, and the toll continues to mount.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a good description of what a lot of us haven't had to go through.
Yeah, that's true. And that's... there's been several articles lately about people today don't want to join the military. The attitude's changed, and the there's a theory that they may have to at some point reinstitute the draft, and it's the word draft doesn't really mean have any impact to most people. It was 50 years ago that we used the word, but for people that face the draft, it changes. I mean, it's a life or death situation. You know, you could, or once you were being drafted or about to be drafted, you only had certain things you could do. You could leave the country. You could become a conscientious objector. You could enlist, which was something I couldn't do. I mean, if you enlisted in the Air Force, you draft was 2 years. And Air Force was 3 years, and the Navy was 4 years. And I just couldn't, after protesting war through 4 years of college, there's no way I could enlist. I couldn't argue that conscientious objector was the way to go. I just couldn't do it. And I couldn't leave the country, because that was, if you left the country, you were a draft dodger. And that was a federal crime at that time, subject to 5 years imprisonment. So you were either going to be imprisoned when you got back, or in my case, I was thinking, if I go to Canada, I can never come back to the United States. It was almost like life imprisonment. So it was like you're going to prison someplace.
Wow.
And therefore, you just basically come down. I came down to the point that I had to take a one-year gamble with my life. You know, I'm going to gamble. I can get in, get it over with, get out, not get killed, and get on with my life. And that's the decision that I made at that point in time.
Yeah, it probably doesn't make for the best soldier.
No.
You know?
Yeah. I have a hard time even calling myself a veteran, much less a soldier.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you know, I showed a little bias there. I mentioned that President Trump got out for bone spurs. I think Biden got out for asthma and something.
If you had money, he got out.
Yeah. If you had money and connections.
Yeah. Platoon, the movie Platoon, Oliver Stone's movie, he shows that very well, because he talks about Charlie Sheen's sitting with these guys, and he said they're the bottom of the barrel from all over the country, you know, little towns, you know, minority people, but he said they're the best we got, you know, and that was true. They were all good guys. They were all good guys, and they were all in the same boat. That was the other thing. I don't care what race, color, creed, religion you were. I had a very dear friend over there. He had been higher up. His family had been high ups in Haiti, the island of Haiti, and there was some military coup or political takeover or something, and he and his family escaped to the United States. And the government said to him, you can become a citizen if you go fight in Vietnam. And I always said he had more culture in his little finger than I had in my whole body. And here he is, we're sitting in a swamp. And he was a great guy, absolutely great guy. And we were all there together. Didn't matter how much, you know, none of us had any money, but the guys that had the money weren't there. But it was an interesting time. There were so many things that were just kind of like mixed up, out of focus. It was amazing.
Okay, Mike, for our last few minutes here, I'm going to let you read from the book, your selection, and tell us a little bit about it, what you're going to read, and treat us to it. Thank you.
The section I've chosen is called Flying Over Vietnam Soil. What I try to describe here is that we are now in the airplane. We're coming from the United States, and we finally hit and fly over, and we can see now the country of Vietnam below. So it's a transition to my prison camp.
Sure. Okay?
So here we go. How do you describe a flight of 23 hours, cramped together, unable to sleep because of the fear? To add more punishment, the Army decides to show us an in-flight movie. They can't and won't serve drinks. Most of the guys are too young to drink. Everyone on this warplane has just experienced Christmas, and now they are showing us a Bob Hope and Lucille Ball movie called Yours, Mine, and Ours. The movie is like a knife cutting the reality of our situation. The movie reminds us of the families and loved ones that we are leaving. The sadness cuts even deeper than the fear we are already feeling. They could have at least shown us a John Wayne war movie, but then remember, it is January 69, and John Wayne movies are not that popular with the young people of America. We are sunk even lower into despair as we watch the two movie families combine and create happiness, knowing that some of us would never experience a family Christmas again. How could they do this to us? It is almost as if they wanted to torture us more than they already had. After 23 hours, we finally encounter land. With my eyes glued to the window, we pass over the beach, which separates the ocean between us and home and the land we have come to. A strange name is designated as our landing area. We are going into Benoit. Benoit, the name. Benoit is our first encounter with this hostile land. Faces are jammed against every available window as we come in over the land. And it is at this point that I am convinced that I'm going to die. The ground is apparently engulfed in total war because we are continually seeing fires and heavy black smoke rising from the lush green land. There are so many fires and so much smoke that my mind tells me that there's no way that I will leave this country alive. My cherry logic being, if the battles are that thick and the country is aflame with war to this degree, then there is no way that I can possibly survive 1 year here. I now realize that I will not survive this prison term. Fear and tears drive through our hearts as we enter this fearful prison. From the air, I've seen that our prison is on fire. My brain knows I'm going to die here. My mind is consumed by fear as the plane rolls to a stop and the door opens. We are here. Get off my airplane, they shout as we are ordered off. As we descend the landing steps, we see another group of 150 guys are lined up. They are waiting to go home. As I step through the airplane door, my breath is literally ripped from my lungs. I'm gasping for air, descending the steps into a heat as hot as hell. I'm gasping. I can't breathe. My lungs won't function in this type of heat. And now I smell the stench of the rotting land. We are landing in a land being consumed not only by war, but by heat, stench, and 100% humidity. The 150 guys waiting there want us off their plane. They want to go home. So I so wish that I was in that group. We stare at them, everyone in our line wishing they were another line. The heat is intense, the smell wicked. Unarmed, we walk from the airplane. With each step I take, it feels I'm moving closer and closer to death. My mind repeats its new mantra. I will not live. I will die here.
Wow, powerful stuff.
Yeah, the transition from one to
from
the
one
other.
World to another. Yeah. Hey, Mike, we're going to have to wrap this up. And we are going to work on a second part because there's a lot we didn't cover here.
Yes, I agree.
You've been listening to KKRN 88.5 FM Community Radio. And thanks for tuning in to my interview with Michael Schlosser and talking about his book, Stalag Vietnam. And
available on
tune
Amazon.
In next.
It's on Amazon.
I'm sorry. There you go. It's available on Amazon. It's a great book. Nice job. Okay, that's going to be a wrap.